I have enjoyed being with you for these hours, meeting several of you, interacting with you. I appreciate very much being invited and meeting the folks who are part of the preaching department here. And so in the words of Isaiah the prophet, you're a great bunch. I have never met a preacher or even a student who has said to me, I have the gift of boring people. It came naturally. I didn't have to go to seminary to study it. I just, one of the things God's given me, and I hope that I'll be able to be better at boring people as my ministry goes on. Never heard that. And yet, many of us commit the awful sin of boring people. And it gets close to a sin, doesn't it? Boredom is not only bad communication, it's the destroyer of life and hope. I mean, we're talking about the most exciting, wonderful person in the universe, in a book that is alive and vital. And somehow we bore people with it. You don't want to do that. I don't want to do it. So the question is there a way we could take our sermons and have a better shot of being interesting? And so what I'd like to do this afternoon is to give you a way of thinking about preaching that is designed to ask, how does the person in the eighth row, four seats in from the end, listen? Most of our outlines deal with the content. Roman numerals, A's, little ones, they're important. Clarity is basic to good preaching. But this doesn't deal with the content in that way. This deals with the way people listen. And if I can construct my messages in a way that folks hear, I have a better chance of being interesting. In order to tell you what I'm doing, lay all the cards out on the table, what I'm talking about really comes from communication theory. If you think of what we're trying to do when we stand up and preach, is we're trying to get and hold people's attention. Difficulty with attention is it's hard to keep it and hold it. The focus of our attention changes as much as 50 times an hour, 50 times a minute. I mean, you're driving down the highway, and the focus is constantly changing. And even sitting here listening to somebody as scintillating and as interesting as I am, I can talk. Oh, you can think five times faster than I can talk. What a dead space there. So you know what happens. I say something, and then your mind goes off, and you come back, and something else, and boof, and back. And, you know, some of you, when I finish, you're going to stay here and realize everybody went home. You were off on an excursion. If I focus on attention by itself, it isn't going to work very well. So there's a second level, and that is we give our attention to what we're interested in. If I am really interested in a subject, I give my attention to it. When Bonnie and I were celebrating our 50th year of marriage, we really celebrated. We went on a cruise in the Mediterranean, started up at Istanbul and went to Ephesus. And the boat on a Sabbath stopped up in Haifa, in the northern part of Israel. Nothing happens in Israel, at least among the Jews, on the Sabbath. And so the ship docked, and I got off just to walk around. get some exercise. And a passenger got off with me, so we walked together. The next day, we were going down to Ashdod, which is in the southern part of Israel. And then people would take tours into Israel. So I said to this fellow, "What are you going to do tomorrow?" He said, "I'm going to rent a car, go up to Jerusalem." I said, "Have you ever been to Israel before?" "No, first time." So I said, "Well, when you go up to Jerusalem, you might want to know that if you stand on the east side of Jerusalem, what they call the Mount of Olives, and you look back, over here you see the city with its walls, but those walls were built by the Crusaders. Over here there's an open place, but that's probably where David and Solomon had their homes. And this is a tunnel there that was dug by Hezekiah. You can actually go through that tunnel as a way of getting water, you know." After I was through with this wonderful explanation, he said to me, I don't give a, "You fill it in. Who am I to curse here in a Baptist seminary?" For old dead kings. That sort of surprised me, put me back. Well, we got down to Ashdod, and Bonnie and I went up to Jerusalem, where Bob Cooley, the former president of Gordon Conwell, greeted us. He is an archaeologist. He took us back to the room, to the ruins that they're digging up with the Romans. Not exactly old dead kings, but old dead Romans. But I thought about that. If we had taken slides, and this fellow I met was taking slides, the slides that we would have taken would be very different. He might have taken slides of the government buildings, the Holocaust Museum. I would have taken slides of old dead kings. In fact, when we got down to Ashdod, they had tours. They had the non-religious tour of Jerusalem and Bethlehem. They had the religious tour of Jerusalem and Bethlehem. I can see what a non-religious tour of Jerusalem would be like. I cannot imagine why somebody who isn't religious would go to Bethlehem. I mean, that's like going to Des Moines, Iowa. Nothing there to see. But people would go on basis of their interest. All that is saying is that we give attention to what we're interested in. And because of my background, I happen to be interested in old Romans and old dead kings. But then there is a deeper level than interest. And that's the level of need. We are most interested in the things that we need. And thus, we give our attention more often to things that we need. If you come up to the Boston area, one of the things you might like to do is to visit our art museum, one of the better ones in the country. If you like art, there's all kinds of art. There's Picasso's and Rembrandt's and Monet's. But imagine you're walking through the museum and you're looking at this art, and then suddenly you realize you've got to find a restroom. The only picture you're interested in is a little picture with a black silhouette of a woman, a man, you know. You pass the great art for that, you know. Why? Because you need it. What you're needed is what you need, you're most interested in, and if you're most interested in something, that's where you give your attention. That's just basic to communication theory. It's got all kinds of empirical evidence behind it. But what I want to talk to you about is based on this psychological reality. So, think of a Sunday morning. It's about 11:25. The congregation has sung its hymns. Choir has given its anthem. There's been the offering. And then you get up. If you could survey that audience, you'd discover that they're all a little bit bored, and they have a suspicion that you're going to make things worse. So if you could... if you could nail down their attitude, it would be a ho-hum. They are not sitting eagerly, hear what you have to say. They're more passive than that. So when you stand to your feet, in your opening words, get attention. The way you get attention is begin with an interesting statement. So your interesting statement gets attention. I think this comes because of television. At least when we were living in Gloucester, Massachusetts, we had cable. And one cable channel dealt with old movies. If you look at the old movies, they all have a standard way to start. They have the title. Then they give you the major actors and actresses. And the supporting cast, then you have the director of photography, director of wardrobe, producer, and then the director, then the picture begins. If you flip the switch and go to another channel with a made-for-television movie, and most movies today are made with television in mind, it's their big secondary market, that thing just starts off. There'll be a picture, and you get into that scene, and then they will give you the title, but the title is over the action. And it's only after you get to the end of the film that they tell you all that stuff. Why? Because they know that if you just tune into television, they got 15 seconds to get you. Now, if you tune in for a particular program, Law and Order, one of those, you'll give it a bit more time. But what happens is you sit there with a clicker in your hand. I think it's more a man thing than a woman thing. But you know how it is. You don't like this? You got 139 other channels. It may never come back. And they know that. They know they've got to get you fast. Well, they may not get you at all. I think when people come to church, they come with clickers in their heads. I knew all this. They make up their mind about you early. If they haven't been to church before, they make up their mind whether they like you or dislike you. Make up your mind, their mind, whether you're going to be interesting or boring, whether it's going to be relevant or not. So your opening statement has to get attention. Aside from the statement of your main idea, those opening words are probably among the most important that you'll speak. You start and you say, I never got the name of the man who was on flight 533 from Boston to Chicago. But after I heard his story, I was glad I didn't know his name. Or you say, suppose God died. I know, he can't die. But suppose he did. And suppose it took 2 weeks for an angel to come from heaven to earth to give you the news. Would you know it before the angel came? let me tell you the worst fear I have. Opening statement. You can't wait around. Got to start and get the tension. The second thing you have to do if you're going to work at this is to after you get the ho-hum, question people ask is, why should I listen? And here, what you do is surface a need. If I can get your attention with my opening statement, then I have to work on need, because we will respond to something we think we need. Let me tell you what doesn't work. Last week, we were in Genesis 22, and this week, we are in Genesis 23. And if you know your math, next week, we'll be in Genesis 24. If you think some guy got up in the morning and said, honey, get up, we've got to get there early, he's going to be in Genesis 24 today, that's a preacher's presupposition. Nobody's right mind cares about the arithmetic. No, early on, you have to raise a need. I had lunch with a publisher in New York a couple of years ago. He was the vice president of the firm, and I asked him what he did. And he said, I evaluate manuscripts to help the company decide what manuscript is going to turn into books published. I said, that's interesting. How many manuscripts do you evaluate in a year? He said, maybe 300, 350. I said, you can't do that. I'm a pretty fast reader. You can't read 350 books a year. Oh, he said, we don't really read all the books or the manuscripts. He says, we have a kind of formula. Formula is, on the first page, the writer goes after the reader's throat. And then the second, third, fourth page, gets his fingers around the throat and begins to squeeze. And the good writers hold that reader up against the wall, breathless until the end. So we get a manuscript that does that, we publish it. Well, it's a pretty violent image. But as another writer told me, you're fighting with every page to get the person to turn it. And you do it because you raise the need. I have a hobby of looking at books, just looking at the first pages of a book. I've done enough writing to know what that's like. You know, you sit with a blank sheet or you blank screen, and you got to start. Now, by page 85, you may be making progress, not thinking at all, but that first two pages, you really are thinking. And you know that you've got to get people's attention, but you also have to surface a need to get them to keep listening. Supposing you were introducing a series, and you said to a congregation, sometime you get a chance to visit New York. Go to New York City, you ought to ride the subways. The subways are not just a place where you can get from point A to point B. They're also a breeding ground for young artists. In fact, you can see their work on the outside of the cars, on the ads and the inside of the cars. I mean, graffiti is everywhere. on the 59th Street Station, Broadway line, there was an ad for vodka. There was a man facing a woman, and a graffiti artist had come along. And out of the man's mouth, he had, "I like girls." Unfortunately, when he wrote that, he misspelled it. So instead of G-I-R-L-S, it was G-R-I-L-S, "I like grills." Another graffiti artist came along right after that, put another balloon, and he said, "It's girls you like, stupid, girls." Another graffiti artist came along, and on top of those, he wrote, "Well, it's all right to like the girls, but what about us grills?" We've all felt that. There's a couple. They've been married now, 11 years. Before they got married, they talked about children. And he said he'd like two, if we could have a boy and a girl. She said she'd like four. 11 years. They don't have any children. They want them, they don't have them. Sometimes they lie awake at night weeping together. When they have a shower for a friend who's going to be married, they send a gift, but she doesn't want to go. She knows the myth that when a bride tosses the bouquet, the one who catches that bouquet is the next one married. She knows it's a lie. She's caught her share of bouquets, and she's not married or does not have children. And sometimes they say to themselves, "God seems to love the girls, but what about us grills?" Or over there, there's a boy. He's 14 years of age, going on 15. More than anything else in the world, he wants to be on the football team. If desire could do it, he would be first string. All summer long, he's been running, lifting weights. They had the tryouts a week ago, and now he looks at the board and names of two of his friends are on the list, but his is not. He's going to spend the season in the grandstands. He looks at that and says, "God loves the girls, but what about us grills?" If you've ever been there, if you've ever felt like a grill in the midst of girls, then there's somebody in the Bible I would like you to see. Person who in his lifetime must have said, "God seems to love the girls, but what about us grills?" Turn with me to, and the question is, would you turn? If you wouldn't, I haven't scored. If you would, then the introduction is done when it's supposed to do. I mean, the test of a good introduction is it gets you to want more. My friend Duane Litvin, who's the president of Wheaton, has said, you know, one of the marks of a good introduction is to have a group of students watch a sermon, but tell them that all they have to do is evaluate the introduction. And then watch and see how many of them watch the introduction and then keep on watching the sermon. That's the test of an introduction. And if you can touch a need, where the people ask, you know, why bring that up? Then you've done what a good introduction should do. a third thing that happens. That is, people ask, what's your big idea? And what you do is tell them what you're talking about. We talked about this last evening. But every good sermon is the embodiment of a single idea. Doesn't mean it has only one idea. It means that all of the ideas in the sermon contribute to that major idea. People don't remember outlines. You don't remember outlines. You want to break up your marriage? Ask your wife what you talked about last Sunday. And then ask her to tell you what it was you said about what you're talking about. Don't do that too often. Divorce courts are filled with preachers who made that mistake. People don't remember the outline. They don't even remember the exegesis of a passage. So what you do is you find the idea that you're driving across, and you do everything you can to drive that across to people. People want to know, what's the sermon about? Just yesterday, I had a conversation with a physician whose father I met when I was in the Christian Medical Society. He's in a town in the Midwest. And he said to me, we've tried a number of churches in our area. He said, it's terrible what passes for preaching these days. He said, I'm a fairly intelligent man. I could leave a church. I don't know what he talked about. And I'm convinced he doesn't know what he talked about. That's a terrible indictment, isn't it? But we said last night, you have two questions. What am I talking about? What am I saying about what I'm talking about? This is another Robinson statistic, not based on anything. It's empirical evidence, but it's guess. I think on a given Sunday, 80% of preachers couldn't answer those two questions. What exactly am I talking about? What am I saying about what I'm talking about? What did you talk about last Sunday? I talked about sin. What did you say about it? I was against it. You get those sermons like that. So somehow or other, you have to know what it is you're trying to get across this Sunday. And don't be embarrassed to tell them. You may tell them at the beginning and have an inductive message. You may lead up to it as a deductive message, but you drive that home. So people want to know. Don't be embarrassed to tell them. A fourth thing that happens when you're developing a sermon is that people ask, for instance, and what you do is you get down to specifics. A lot of preachers are five-star generalists. They're up there in the stratosphere. But when you're trying to develop something, the question people have is, for instance, for example, show us. Virtually everything you need to do in a sermon can be turned into an example, something people can see. There's only three things you can ever do with an idea, by the way. You can explain it, you can prove it, you can apply it. If I say to you, going to have a miserable weather tomorrow, First question you'll ask me, what do you mean by miserable weather? I say, well, I understand we're going to have a snowstorm. We're going to have 5 foot of snow here in Waco. The second question is, how do you know that? Is that true? Do I believe it? If I tell you I saw it on the Weather Channel and it's in the paper, then the next question you ask is, well, so what? What difference does it make? Well, we'll have to close the school. Baylor will be shut down. That's all you can ever do with an idea. Explain it, prove it, or apply it. And illustrations can help you to do all three. Illustrations help you to explain. C.S. Lewis was trying to explain why theology was important, especially in talking to people who have had some exciting spiritual experience. And he said one time he was speaking to the members of the Royal Air Force, and he was talking some theology with them, and an old grizzled sergeant stood up in the middle of his talk and said, I don't have any use for all that stuff, all this talk about God. Now, I believe in God. I met him out there alone at night. And when you've experienced God, you don't need this talk about him. And C.S. Lewis said, you have to agree with that man. It is more exciting to have the experience of God than to have the talk about God. Just as walking by the side of the ocean, feeling the spray in your face, tasting a bit of the salt, hearing the gawk of the seagulls, it's a very real experience. It certainly is more gripping than going to your office and looking at a map of the Atlantic, which is just colored paper. But he said, if you ever want to go anyplace on the ocean, the map is absolutely essential. So he says, theology is like that map. He was simply explaining theology versus experience. So illustrations can explain. Illustrations can also win consent, belief. Dorothy Sayers, the mystery writer, was talking about the moral law of God. It's a concept that the Catholic theologians have worked with for years. Hard concept to get across. And she said, a lot of folks believe that the law of God is sort of arbitrary. Like the rules at the country club. In order to get into the country club, you have to pay a certain fee, you have to live in the area. They have all the rules. And if they're not getting enough membership, they can broaden the rules. They can change them. And people feel that's true of the law of God, that, you know, he's got these rules, but if he wants to, he can change them. Sort of arbitrary on his part. And then Dorothy Sayers said, you know, there's the difference between the law of the stop sign and the law of the fire. Law of the stop sign says that traffic's been going through town. They put up a stop sign. And they have a fine. You go and run the stop sign, it costs you $50. If a number of people run the stop sign, they can raise it. They can make it $100. Or if a new highway comes in around the city, then the traffic pattern changes, and they can, if they want to, take the stop sign down. Law of the stop sign. People think that's the like the laws of God. But then she said, there's love the stop sign, there's the law of the fire. And she said, imagine that all of the legislatures of all of the nations of the entire world were to gather in one great confab, and they were to vote unanimously that from here on out, fire will not burn. She said, the first delegate who leaves that assembly, puts his hand into a fire, will discover that the law of the fire and the law of the stop sign, very different. And she says the moral law of God is like the law of the fire. You don't break God's laws, you just break yourself upon them. And God cannot change the law of the fire without changing the fire itself. So the moral law of God is bound up into the nature of the universe. I read that 40 years ago. But every time I read a discussion of the moral law of God, I think of stop signs and fire. It's a way of winning proof, winning assent. There is a last thing that you do. Before you're through, people ask, so what? What difference does this make? And what you do is suggest an action. This question is crucial today. So what? What difference does it make? As I look at preaching today, the more effective preachers spend more time on this. They try to picture a situation in which this would be put into practice. What they do is imagine, in essence, somebody comes to their office on a Monday and says, I heard your sermon on Sunday, but I work in an office. And I got people there who really hassle me all the time. And you talked about the need to love an enemy. How do I do that? People would like to see, so you suggest an action. You can't suggest for every truth an action that people can do the next week. On my desk, I have a bit of doggerel. It says, as Tommy Snooks and Betty Brooks were leaving church on Sunday, said Tommy Snooks to Betty Brooks, tomorrow will be Monday. It's got to be the ultimate low of social conversation. But for a preacher, it's an ultimate high. Tomorrow is Monday. What good is this going to do them? Good applications help people see how this can be put into place next week. But you can't always do that. Some truths are for the long run. We lived up in Oregon for several years. And as you drive up into the mountains, they have this sign that says, beware of falling rock. It's got to be the stupidest sign they've ever put on a highway. When you look up and you have these huge boulders, and if they begin to fall, you boom, you're over the side. Beware of falling rock that's going to hit you and you're gone. But there is a reality to that, that is, in life, there are falling rocks that will hit us. And sometimes, as a preacher, I'm preparing people for the falling rock. And one way you can do that is what Alan Munro says is a visualization. What you try to do is to put people into a situation in which they'll use your truth and they can imagine it coming to pass. It has to be possible, even better, probable. I suppose you're preaching on the 46th Psalm. Lord is our refuge and strength, an available help in the time of trouble. And then at the end of each of the stanzas, it's the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of even Jacob is our strength. And you've opened that psalm up and you've driven home that idea that the Lord is a refuge and strength, available help in the time of trouble. But then suppose you say, I don't know how it happened to you. Maybe some night, 2 a.m, the phone rings. And you're awakened and you reach over to find the receiver and you pick it up and suddenly the voice on the other end tells you something that jolts you awake. Somebody who is close to you. Somebody on whom you have depended for your emotional security is gone. You try to get some information. You put the phone back in its cradle. And you know life has changed. You'll have a mixture of fear, of questioning. And then suddenly, in the middle of that experience, you'll remember this word from God. That God is your refuge and strength, an available help in the time of trouble. The fear will still be there. The questions don't disappear. But you will sense from the truth of this psalm that whatever you're going to go through, you won't go through alone. That's visualization. Think of a situation, possible, probable. Put people into it, and then take the idea of your sermon and apply it to their lives. Oh, that's the motivated sequence. The first two things are two steps are part of your introduction. This is the next two are the essence of the body, and this is in your conclusion. This is how the people listen. And the more you can make your sermon fit that pattern, the more likely it is that you'll get and hold people's attention. And you will have preached in the way that listeners like it. Well, I deeply appreciate the attention you've given. And would you let me pray for you before you leave? Our Lord, thank you for these friends who have come. Thank you for the ministries in which they are involved. Thank you that they're not satisfied with where they are, but they're always trying to move to be better. I commend them to you. I commend their churches to you. Commend their families to you. And, O Lord God, would you work in us and for us and through us, that in our ministry and in our preaching, Jesus Christ will be honored and people will be helped.